Hello, and welcome to another episode, number 4, of the Star Trek Discovery Podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Adam.
And this time around, we are here to discuss the second episode of the first season of Star Trek Discovery, which you could also consider the second part of the pilot, titled Battle at the Binary Stars, which I still keep thinking in my head about Battle of the Network Stars. Story by Brian Fuller, the former showrunner, and teleplay by the current showrunners, Gretchen J. Berg and Aaron Harberts.
And hey, Brian. Sorry to interrupt for a second, but I had a question for you, because maybe some of our listeners are a little bit green on this terminology like I am. What's the difference between a story credit and a teleplay?
Well, the teleplay is the script. So, what do they call it in movies? It's not a teleplay. They say screenplay by. So that's the actual script that is used to, direct the episode. So, you know, that's what's got the dialogue. The story is a treatment, which is, I think, usually about 8 pages long, but it is a reduced size. But it's like originally the way it works is first there's an outline, and then there's a story, which is, like I say, about, I think it's about 6 or 8 pages long. And then that is written out to a script, which is the teleplay.
Okay, so the story was the sort of thing that you wrote and were pitching into them back in the 90s.
Yeah, well, it was more like the outline I was pitching. So that's why I didn't get any screen credit, because the outline doesn't get any screen credit.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. All right, and this was directed by Adam Kane. All right, so we don't have any ratings this time, but we do have a little bit of news and some speculation and a little bit of info. So that is open a ship-wide announcement. Well, we do have some errata, just really quickly.
Incorrect.
And I'm going to call you out because you said on the episode that we were going to see Lorca this episode.
Yeah, I can blame the CBS All Access app for that. There was a trailer for the show after the first episode, and he was in it. So I assumed that was a trailer for the next episode, not for future in the season.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a byproduct of us, you know, podcasting about the one episode and only watching the one episode. And then, you know, so we didn't know what the second episode was. So, yeah, it's understandable. But anyway, first bit of note, and this is kind of speculation, I guess. Originally, I saw credits like Wikipedia and IMDb, where it had listed as the writer Nicholas Meyer. And as you notice, Nicholas Meyer's name was not in the story or the teleplay, which makes me think that perhaps his name will be on the next episode. Maybe. Don't know.
Oh, like because this was really two halves of one episode. They're counting the story that he wrote as what would be the second episode if they hadn't split this one into two parts.
Correct. So
possible. Okay. Possible.
So, yeah, I'm not making a prediction, but I am curious. One bit of a news item, and it was something I saw last time, but we didn't mention it, is that the USS Discovery has actually been seen. And that was, it flew over New York City on Saturday night. So CBS had some kind of promotion where I don't know if it was a balloon or something like that, but they had it. So it was you know, flying over New York City. So people saw it then.
That's really impressive. They're not holding back on the marketing for this show whatsoever.
Yeah. So I have something else listed there, but we're going to talk more about that actually during the episode. So a little bit about last episode. So just something that Jeff Childs said. He said, "I agree with your opinion about the holograms. I get that they are trying to make this for 21st century sensibilities, but that is way outside of canon." So we will talk more about this later. Still, you know, kind of fighting with some of this stuff, but I'm a little more, you know, accepting. All right. So we also got some feedback from Nathan saying, "Get on with it." That's the short form. So let's get on with it. Hopefully this is a little bit better, Nathan. And I'm sure if it's not, you'll tell us. All right. Adam, what did you think of Battle at the Binary Stars?
Well, when I originally watched it, I was very satisfied with it. But the problem with being a podcaster is you have to think of things critically. So I'm going to downgrade mine all the way to a 6.5 seconds to reach the bulkhead doors.
Wow.
Yeah. I was able to poke a lot of holes through it once I started thinking about it more critically. Upon first viewing, though, it was extremely satisfying.
Well, I liked it more than that. I gave it 8.75 dimly lit court martials. And I had it rated higher than that, and I lowered it. And, you know, I was kind of hovering near the 9 on that, but I settled on 8.75. So, Malika actually gave us a rating on the second episode. I did not find any other ones in the comments, and perhaps in voicemail we might have gotten one. But Malika, I guess I'll give it since I keep talking. I give the second episode a solid 8.5 time jumps. All right.
Okay, that's a pretty high rating.
Yeah, it's a good rating. All right. Well, we still call Awesome Sauce right now Awesome Sauce. So my Walking Dead co-host Ruthie says, "Awesome Sauce." All right. So let's start with, okay. Well, it's basically our Awesome Sauce. So I didn't realize no one else gave any until now. Adam, what's your first awesome sauce?
Well, the first awesome sauce for this week has to go to the use of the weapons. I don't recall ever having a torpedo warhead beamed onto a corpse before.
Yeah, I agree. The was an interesting use and actually decent strategy, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
how about you, Brian?
Well, I'm going to highlight a couple of things that when you're starting to think about whether it's canon or not canon, I would have to put these two things as, you know, not canon. So these are things that they've changed in this version of Star Trek. The first one is I like the warping in effect and how that looked at both of the Klingons and the Federation ships and the battle scenes. So it's different. It's not what we were used to on how they did it, but I thought it was a really interesting, cool, you know, updated effect. So I enjoyed that part.
Yeah, it's a lot more jarring, but I think that's kind of what they're going for, the way they sort of pop in now instead of stretch into frame.
This is not your father's Star Trek.
That's right.
All right.
Yeah. And kind of along those same lines, I like the constant tension throughout this episode. It just never really let up. Even when they weren't firing at each other, there was that tension of when is the next shot coming. I thought they did a really good job with the pacing and building the drama and suspense that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, my final awesome sauce is again, not exactly, you know, compatible with what kind of things we've seen in Star Trek, but, you know, updated. I thought it was really cool, actually, the time when the bridge got hit and there was a hull breach and the force field kicked in. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it seems like a no-brainer if you're going to have a starship that you'd have some sort of backup in case there's a hole in it. So I'm glad that they finally addressed that problem.
Yes. All right, so that's it for our awesome sauce. And Nathan, we consider this talking about the episode, so if you don't, sorry about that, but that's how we look at it. Anyway, now for weak sauce.
You're worthless and weak!
All right, well, Mark Decote, he has a couple of them, so why don't you give the first one, Adam?
Yeah, this week's sauce comes from our listeners here. This is Mark Decote. His first point is that he said, when the captain learned that the brig level was hit, instead of looking all melancholy, why didn't she try hailing them to see if there were any survivors?
That's a damn good point, Mark. It is kind of funny. There were some kind of actions like that as well. I'm not going to highlight anything specific right now, but I do have something in the weak sauce in a minute that kind of fits the same kind of thing. It's like, well, why didn't he do this instead? It doesn't make sense. So Mark's second weak sauce, he said, did Michael switch the phaser to kill? When they first arrived on the ship, the phasers were in blue mode, which I presume is stun. But when she shot Tecovma, the phaser was set to red mode, which I presume is kill. Was that her anger showing through? Their mission to capture him, and she could have done that instead of killing him. Oh, sorry, I wrote that, said that wrong. Their mission was to capture him, and she could have still done that instead of killing him. Yeah, I had a similar kind of thing because Burnham could have taken Tecovma prisoner simply by, you know, stunning him and putting some, you know, transponder on him or something that would signal that out to Saru and, you know, could beam him into the brig or whatever. Well, I guess the brig's kind of screwed up, but still could have beamed him to the Shenzhou, but she didn't do that. So as far as I'm concerned.
And you blew it. You blew it. You blew it. You blew it. You had it all and you blew it.
Yeah. So instead she shoots at him, puts a hole in him and martyrs him.
Yeah. That was a bit of a head scratcher.
And in general, I had, and I use the word bipolar. Please don't take offense to that, people, but I simply mean she was all over between her logical and emotional nature. Like there were times when she was, you know, very Vulcan-like with her logic, like specifically in the brig, getting out of the brig. But at the same time, you know, the actions like, you know, like killing Tecovma, like, you know, do the actions that cause the court martial, extremely emotional in nature and not very logical to me. So I struggled with that.
Yeah. I don't know if that was poor writing or if that's a deliberate plot point of the character, is that she grapples with her Vulcan upbringing and her emotional human nature.
Yeah. All right. Well, now it's for our weak sauce. So why don't you give your first?
Well, this is why I actually rated the episode so low. The biggest problem I had with the episode was that they continued the fight after their ship was already disabled. They had agreed to a ceasefire and then been told by Tecovma, go back to the Federation and tell them what's coming. It's totally contrary to the Federation's nature to continue a fight when they don't need to. They're the first one not to run away, but to accept a cessation of hostility at the earliest sign. So for them to basically go out for blood or continue the mission in the face of certain peril. It just seemed completely out of character for anything a Star Trek Starfleet captain would do. So that was my first week's sauce.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. Well, as far as the whole thing about them going after T'Kuvpa, I had issue with just Georgiou's decision making there. So they go after to get him, and they only go with the captain and, you know, the now, you know, under custody or whatever first officer, like no one else. Like, I've been watching Enterprise. Okay. And, you know, they had the Makos, like a whole assault team, you know, and I would think that maybe the Makos, whatever, don't exist anymore, but we know that there are tactical people and there are security people. And I would have to think that there'd be still some of those people alive on the Shenzhou. Send as many people as you got and take them by force, you know?
Yeah, I feel like this is just one of those Star Trek tropes we have to put up with. It stems all the way back to the original series. Again, a ship full of people, and you're going to send the two most important ones out on the most dangerous missions. It doesn't make a lick of sense, but it is true to form, so...
I didn't mind that it was that the two of them were going on the mission, but they should have had backup. You know, there should have been an assault team. I don't get that part of it, that only two of them would go to get him. I mean, what if they ran into 100 Klingons over on that ship? You know, it clearly didn't make a lot of sense for me to go with just two people.
Well, they haven't invented red shirts yet, so they were clearly confused on who to send over there to get killed.
Yeah, everyone's a blue shirt.
Right? Yeah, my problem with the mission actually was, and this has happened in other Star Trek series as well, Klingons are supposed to be physically stronger than humans overall, and the males especially. We've seen this on countless episodes, and yet still somehow we're seeing human women who are able to overpower Klingon men in battle. You know, when Captain Georgiou has to deflect a blade from T'Kuvpa, she's able to not only stop it, but then push him back off of her. And that just doesn't seem physically possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. What else you got?
Well, the other thing that I thought was very convenient for the purposes of the story was that the entire brig gets destroyed except for Burnham's cell. Like, how does a perfectly rectangular patch of deck get salvaged when the entire rest of the room and the few decks above and below it get blown away?
Yeah, I have no comeback on that, because I mean, the one positive thing that I could say about it is that I really did like how Burnham used logic against the computer to make her escape. It reminded me of some things that we've seen Captain Kirk do in the original series.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, I thought that was kind of a novel escape, or, you know, particularly it was an escape that I didn't expect through logic versus, you know, through brute force or, you know, some kind of technological trickery to extend the brig or something to allow them for her to get to the other side or something, you know, whatever.
Yeah. She wasn't able to hack into a wall panel or something.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It was a novel way of doing it. And I have to say, and I like to use this term about red shirts. Certainly Ensign Connor was, you know, what we would classically call a red shirt, and I would call him Ensign Expendable.
Oh, that poor guy.
Oh, yeah.
He gets blown up on the bridge only to survive that and get blown up elsewhere. They really didn't like him.
Yeah, I felt bad for that guy. All right. Well, I had two other ones. And the first, I'm going to do this out of order, well, in the notes, but it's in order of the way it was on the show. Why did Saru need Georgiou's life sign to be able to beam her away? I mean, couldn't he have gotten it based on her previous life sign? Or did they only get life signs at the moment that he was trying to beam them out? That didn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, he should have been able to approximate where she was and beam whatever it was that was there, you know?
Yeah, even as far back as Enterprise, they're able to beam cargo back and forth, and that doesn't have any life signs. So it doesn't make sense that you have to have a living creature to be able to beam it.
And for that matter, you know, she didn't have any kind of like transponder or, I don't know, communicator on her.
That's right. They carried communicators back in this era of Star Trek.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I'll piggyback on that one because they, in the very same episode, they were able to beam a warhead onto a Klingon corpse. Clearly no life signs. Maybe it's because they had line of sight and were able to plot it that way.
Maybe. And I referred to this in my rating. What was the deal with the dimly lit court-martial? I did not get that at all. It reminded me of like Star Trek VI and, you know, Kirk and McCoy getting assigned, you know, to the mining colony Ruapenthe or whatever.
Yeah.
And, yeah. That did not seem Federation to me. I expect things to be okay. We talked last time about the colors being, you know, rather austere, but I wouldn't expect the lighting austere. Like, you know, Earth is the war going so badly that they need to conserve lighting? The power is too much to. You know, make sure that the court martial room is, you know, decently lit.
All the Federation credits are going into the war effort. There's none left for the electric bill, apparently.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is it for our weak sauce, I think, unless you have something else that I don't see on our notes.
No.
Okay. So now it is time for feedback. So we are going to open Hailing Frequencies. And we have a message from Mark again. So he has left us voicemail on episode 2. And I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to this one, Adam, but I have not listened to this one, so I'm going into it cold.
Oh, same as me. I like to be surprised.
All right. Well, here we go.
Hey, Brian. Hi, Adam. Mark from Ontario, Canada here. And this is my feedback for Star Trek Discovery Episode 2. Well, that was a fun series. It's too bad that Michael didn't get to live out her dreams, and now she's imprisoned for life. Well, at least it'll make it a lot easier for people to binge-watch in the future, having only 2 episodes following her. No, seriously, though. I really like the way this show is progressing so far. Now, I won't lie, I am missing the close-ended episodic Star Trek from past, but I am really getting into this serialized story that we're now following. It's feeling more like a Star Trek movie to me than a Star Trek TV show, just viewed over a longer period, and I'm really digging that. Now, one scene I want to point out is in the flashback where Michael first arrives on the Senjo, and the captain takes her onto the bridge for the very first time. As the doors open, I was listening to that scene. If you ignore the dialogue, just listen to the background noises, and it's all the familiar sounds from Star Trek. All the bridge noises, the beeps, the whistles, everything that you remember. I actually rewound that scene and just listened to it with my eyes closed just to get those sounds from episodes past. So great job just bringing that all into the Star Trek universe. Now, speaking of the Star Trek universe, those Klingon ships, I don't know about you, but almost none of them did I recognize as a Klingon design. Now, I looked up some images from the original series as well as Enterprise, and if this takes place between the two, I don't know what happened with their ship designs, because the ships from Enterprise kind of look like the original series ships, but none of these ones did. I mean, some of them did have the neck, the bird of prey look with neck, kind of the shape, but just overall, I found the Klingon ships didn't look right. Now, I'd like your opinion. Was Michael right if they had fired first? Do you think that would have belayed this whole incident. And, well, it would mean we wouldn't really have a series, I guess. But do you think she was correct in that reasoning, that if they would have fired first, it would have had a different outcome? And there's something that I didn't quite understand in this series, and I'd like your take on it. When the Klingon ship collides with the Europa, and really cool effects, by the way, but at the end, the Europa, after ejecting all its survival pods, it self-destructs. And when the debris clears, we see open space. What happened to the Klingon ship? Did it recloak? It wasn't destroyed, because from what I understood, that was that leader Klingon guy. It was his ship. So where did it go? I'm a little confused on that part. Now, with most feedback that I send into podcasts, I like to find little things to nitpick on. Not really that I didn't like them, but just little observations. For one thing, we got last episode where all the Klingon ships arrived at the same time. And then this episode, all the Federation ships arrived at the same time. What were they doing? Coordinating this? They're supposedly coming from all over the galaxy, which in my thinking would mean they would be arriving sporadically at different time periods. But no, they are all arriving within seconds of each other. So did they all rendezvous one place and then make a jump from there so they'd all arrive at the same time? Or did they coordinate their departures? I don't know. And between the time that this takes place and 10 years from now, when the original series takes place, I don't know if Starfleet just had to cut costs or something and they decided to stop making those metallic emblems and started sewing them onto the uniforms. And speaking of cutting costs, they must have done away with that holographic projection way of communicating with each other, because we didn't see that in the original series. Heck, I don't even think we saw that in The Next Generation. So where did that come from? Anyways, I am really enjoying the series. Can't wait till next week's episode. And I'm enjoying the podcast. Keep up the great work, guys. Mark from Ontario, Canada, out.
Well, thanks, Mark. Again, great feedback, and look forward to feedback going, you know, forward on, you know, hopefully we'll be hearing from you on a regular basis. Well, so again, fantastic feedback. And typically what we give, and I think I may have given this to you last time, but you win our showcase. So, and there's so much to dig into with your feedback. Adam, anything you want to highlight?
Well, his comments tie a lot into what we were talking about offline between shows, which is a lot of the design discrepancies between this show and, you know, previous established canon. And I think a lot of it, until they explain otherwise, I'm personally just going to chalk up to being 2017 and having new technology available and bigger budgets. They couldn't do such a thing as a hologram well on the shoestring budget of 1960s television, nor probably did they even consider that the badge on the insignia on their uniforms would be such a pivotal point in the future. So it was really an ornamentation that just kind of matured as the series developed.
Yeah. And I think took more meaning into the movies as well, because we started seeing it, you know, on other ships and whatnot. I agree with you. I will say that it, you know, is pretty obvious at this point that the Klingons were redesigned in more than just the way that they look. The ships look nothing like the, you know, and as you know, I've been watching Enterprise, and those, you know, we see in the Enterprise show, you know, we see Birds of Prey, and, you know, they may be less sleek and, you know, don't have cloaking technology, but they look like, Klingon Birds of Prey, you know, and we see just, the one thing I was encouraged about, I did see, like, from the holograms of the 24 houses, I did see Klingons that were wearing dress that was more like the Klingons we've gotten used to. Okay, so that I was very thankful to see, like, particularly Cole, he was wearing a uniform or, you know, outfit, whatever you want to call it, that look very much like we're used to seeing a Klingon, you know, officer wear. So, you know, but it's hard for me to still resolve the fact that the only one I can think of, and there may be others, but General Chang in Star Trek VI is the only bald Klingon that I can think of. And he looked nothing like these bald Klingons. Like his ridges were kind of like faded out. And, you know, of course he had that eye patch glue, you know, kind of drilled into his head. But aside from that, like his
didn't he have a little ponytail in the back?
You may be correct. I know one character, I think maybe the Chancellor, had a ponytail. Like, I don't know, but, anyway, that's the closest I can think of a Klingon that looks anything like, these bald Klingons. Like, the thing is that the Klingons that we've become used to, and I, you know, and you can't say from, you know, TOS era, but certainly from essentially motion picture era and forward, although the designs like evolved a little bit, you know, up until Enterprise, say, those Klingons had long, long, luxurious kind of, I don't know, like not real straight hair. Most of them, they had kind of a little wave in it, mm-hmm. but long, luxurious hair. And these are bald. And I am saying the same kind of thing that you are. I'm saying, look, don't judge it by the things that we've seen, because quite frankly, if that's what you're going to get hung up on, this show will just drive you crazy. I don't think that at this point we're going to see a Star Trek that looks like the Star Treks that we know. And in fact, I've been thinking about this. I wanted to mention this too. How does this affect the movies? Because the movies, yes, it's a different universe, but already, like, this universe is a major update, I would say, from the Kelvin universe's look. Like, it's so radically different. And, you know, I have to say, I think this is a visual reboot. Like, it's a partial redesign, certainly like they're trying to stick to story, but when it comes to technology and look, they're just completely throwing a lot of it out and, you know, going the other way. And if I think of it like, say, you know, Ron Moore's reimagining of Battlestar Galactica, that to me is almost equivalent to what we're seeing in Star Trek Discovery. So, you know, the first question, and one thing that we should mention this, I think, we're going to help answer the question, I think, this in this episode, especially for U.S. Listeners. Should you get CBS All Access, and, you know, should you like binge it, or should you have the membership and watch from week to week? We're going to answer that question as we go. But the first thing I would say is, if you can't accept changes in the universe like this, then just forget it. Just move on.
Yeah. The biggest burden that this show has is its insistence on claiming that it's going to connect to established canon. If they had just simply come out, like you said, with Battlestar Galactica and admitted this is somewhat of a clean slate, this show would be fantastic, you know? But because there's all these other things that frankly didn't connect that well together, because Trek's always had plot holes and inconsistencies throughout.
Yeah.
Trying to bring all that together is such a burden. I just hope it doesn't distract from the story that this show is trying to tell.
Yeah. And I think, you know, unfortunately, I think it has, but you know, after two episodes, you got to ask yourself, you know, is it okay that they've changed some things? And my impression at this point, I'll give an early indication. I think the answer is yes. I think what the most important thing about this show is, you know, whether or not you want to watch it, is it going to be a good story? And is it something you're going to want to see? And I think the answer is going to be yes. Although there's a hell of a lot of open questions that we have. And we've got one right off the top that's coming up that you brought up. And I will definitely be piggybacking on what you said there. So next is Nathan. So we've got that came in through our feedback form. So actually, we got a couple of pieces of feedback from Nathan. So why don't you read the one that came through the our feedback page, which is at goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback.
Sure. He says, I just watched the first two episodes, and I got to say, I love what I've seen. Exciting and engaging Star Trek that we will all hopefully get to know. This is the only thing I am worried about. Will we get to know these characters? Star Trek has always prided itself on slowing down and having random episodes that are not anything to do with the major arc, but simply the characters and their relationships. I hope this happens on Discovery. It definitely has more in common with Abrams' Star Trek than anything the previous incarnations have shown, but that's okay. We all need to evolve a little bit. We should all be happy that we've got the previous show and so many episodes to enjoy. Let's embrace Star Trek back on TV where it belongs. The show itself was interesting. I enjoyed the interplay between the main characters and look forward to more adventures. Michelle Yeoh's captain was interesting, but not that engaging in my opinion. Would have been nice to have her character warm up slightly before they killed her off. I look forward to Jason Isaacs showing up and seeing what he has to offer. The Klingons were also great, probably my favorite part of both episodes. The menace was clear and intense whilst always retaining a familiarity that we know. It was something we definitely have not seen before, which I enjoyed. In summary, a strong start. I hope this trend continues and the show is grave enough to slow down occasionally and let us interact with the minutiae of these characters.
All right. Well, thanks for that feedback, Nathan. He continues from the Facebook page. He says, what do you think of the big kill at the end of this episode? I liked Michelle Yeoh character, but didn't really connect with her. I thought her sudden departure was maybe a bit premature. It would have been nice for at least a few more episodes. I thought the spoiler alert was in the opening credits, which I loved, when Michelle Yeoh's character was not featured as a cast member. So I would say that it was telegraphed. You know, when you see special guest star, I don't think we're done in seeing Michelle Yeoh. I have a feeling we're going to be seeing her in flashbacks, especially since we did see several flashbacks in this these two episodes. So I don't think that, you know, she did two episodes and out. I think that her commitment to this show was, you know, quite a bit more than that. I mean, considering, you know, how much they probably had to pay Michelle Yeoh, even as a special guest star. I have to think that she's probably at least in another 3 to 5 episodes, you know, in flashback, obviously. But nevertheless, I do expect to see her again. What do you think about that part?
I would agree with you. Her character is so formative to the transition period between when Burnham left Vulcan and the point at which this series begins, that I don't think we've seen the last of her, because I could tell with their storytelling devices that there's going to be plenty of opportunities for them to jump back in time to revisit that 7-year span and, you know, relay a pertinent bit of Burnham's past with Georgiou as it relates to whatever current events are going on.
Yeah. And, you know, I thought about what they did with Michelle Yeoh, and I wondered why they did not offer the same special guest star credit to James Frayne, because he was definitely a big feature in this. You know, he was in at least between the two episodes, I think he was in at least four scenes, maybe more. You know, a couple in flashback, you know, one through a mind meld, one through, you know, the hologram. And I guess, by the way, I guess Burnham doesn't need to call him via hologram anymore, does she?
Yeah, yeah. James Frayne, by the way, for our listeners, if you don't have the cast memorized yet, is Sarek.
Yes. Yeah. So, and I thought that was kind of interesting that they could kind of do a long distance mind meld like that.
That's a new wrinkle. It's one of those things that was never established previously, but there's nothing to contradict it either.
And we do know that, you know, the Katra, you know, has, we have seen, you know, both in the movies and in several episodes, you know, the effect of, you know, one's Katra. We saw, like Archer, for example, carrying the Katra of Sirach. You know, we've seen in the Sarek episode, I don't know specifically that would be considered his Katra, but, you know, Picard, I saw one place where someone speculated, does that mean that part of Picard is in Burnham too? which I thought was novel.
It travels light years. It doesn't travel time.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's pretty impressive that, you know, you can make a connection to someone like that over 1,000 light years. And talk about, like, does he have, like, a greater connection to Burnham than he does to, you know, even his own son, Spock? Because they were always kind of, like, distant between the two of them every time that we've seen them together.
True. That was a strained relationship from the start. And I don't think, in fact, Spock might have mentioned this in the unification episodes. He never shared a mind meld with Sarek, actually.
Right. I remember that. Yeah. Yeah. So I think at some point we're going to find out how Spock fits into this. Like, we know that Spock isn't Mr. Forthcoming person, you know, like, he never said a damn word about Cybok until Star Trek V. You know, never mentioned that he was married, or was he married or about to be married? I can't remember. It's been a long time since I've seen that. But, you know, didn't mention that either. So, in Amok Time, you know, so that. That's, of course, the famous one with the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, where he fights Kirk.
Classic.
Classic is right. And I love that theme, actually. But so I wonder, you know, like I say, if they had offered special guest star to James Frayne, it would have provided a bit of a cloak to whether Georgiou was going to survive or not. So
that would be a bit of a device, as you're saying?
Yes. Yes.
Nice teamwork. Okay, yeah. Moving on.
Yeah. Yeah, next is Karen. She just has a little thing there. So just in summary, she agrees that Michelle Yeoh should have been with us a few weeks longer, and I think she will be. Why don't you give Malika's?
Yeah, Malika chimed in again. She said she feels that the second episode should also have been available for non-subscribers due to it actually setting up the show. The first was not enough to get people on the wagon, in my opinion. Her opinion. They were all over the place with the timeline, but I liked getting the background. My fiance and stepson have been enjoying it thoroughly, and they are Trekkies. They play Attack Wing at a couple of comic book stores around town.
And I was actually thinking about this myself before I saw your feedback, Malika, and I 100% agree with you. I think CBS made a mistake. I think that if they had shown the entire 2-hour, and, you know, let's just call it an episode, but, you know, the whole thing in its entirety on CBS, A, it would have been a, you know, like a Star Trek, you know, TV movie, essentially. And I think it would have, like, if viewers got to see that, you know, hey, you know, Burnham's been court-martialed and she's been, you know, sentenced to life in prison and you know, lost all of her rank and everything. Like, she's like, you know, how are they going to resolve that? I think that would have been a better, you know, launching point for the rest of the story than seeing the Klingons all, you know, warp into place. And, it, you know, so, and we didn't mention that, neither of us did, about Mark's feedback about the Klingons and the Federation all kind of showing up all at the same time. Yeah, I kind of agree with that too. I hadn't thought of it until you said it, but it was rather convenient that all of these ships kind of, you know, showed up right at the same time, especially on the Federation side. And the only one that didn't show up at the same time was the Europa. Also convenient.
It's the cranky Admiral again. He's not going to jump right into the forefront.
Yeah.
That Admiral was cranky through the whole two-part series.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder, actually, if we're ever going to get a truly competent admiral in Star Trek besides Kirk, because so far they've either tried to directly blow up the protagonists or just defy them or court-martial them. Like, there's the higher-ups never have our main characters' backs, it seems.
Well, I can think of one admiral that was Admiral Admiral Janeway.
Oh, I forgot she became an admiral.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
She was an admiral in Nemesis. So I would definitely say that, you know, she was, and I'm not, you know, not talking about time travel or anything like that, because we know, you know, in several different, you know, versions, Picard became an admiral. And what was he in All Good Things? Was he an ambassador? I forget, but.
Ambassador, yeah.
Yeah. So I want to see that. I want to see that the Enterprise D with the third nacelle. I love that, actually.
The hot rotted Enterprise D.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of missed that. We'll never get to see that. But
yeah, I actually thought the Klingons showing up simultaneously was even more curious, given that I don't think they were even expecting any sort of a summons. So to all pop in identically and that quickly, I would expect the Federation to respond faster than the Klingons.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't have anything to say beyond that. I think that was a really good observation that Mark made. And I forgot to mention that earlier. So, but anyway, Malika, yeah, 100% agree with you. I think they should have done it as a 2-hour movie. It would have been better, I think, all the way around. And, they didn't do it because I think they want as much, money as possible. And, you know, even to the point, I hate to say this, I don't know how they monetize this stuff, but considering it came out on September 24th, the next episode comes out on what, October 1st? Mm-hmm. So, you know, depending on how they monetize it, you know, they get memberships for September and October.
But you factor in that free trial and they're not making anything this month.
No, but it may give them subscription numbers, you know.
Oh, yeah. Bragging rights.
Yes. So, you know, and let's face it. I think that's not beyond them.
You know, actually, I'll cue this up for Arata next week. I think I read an article saying that they're quoting a subscriber base of about 4 million right now. So apparently Discovery has done what it was intended to do, which is boost numbers. But we'll see how many actually stick around now that they got to start paying money to see the real launch of the series.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it was an obvious cash grab to cut the story in half and make people go online for the second half, whereas they telling a complete story on the network and then telling them if they want to continue with the series, they could go on to All Access.
Yeah, because, you know, if they did it the other way, you know, they literally just get membership in October and, you know, beginning of November, and that's it, you know? So I don't know. I tend to think that was financial and nothing more. All right. So we got one more bit of feedback, and that is from Steve. He said, I guess I assumed the character was half Vulcan like Spock, not just raised on Vulcan. I liked the battle and using the body of the dead Klingon to hide the bomb. It was cool. It reminded me of the original Star Trek when the captain and first officer beamed over. Yeah, it was very, very much like that, you know, back, you know, with Next Generation and beyond, the, you know, the concept of, you know, the first officer, beaming in and not the captain. You know, we saw that much less on Voyager, and, you know, it was mostly Chakotay going down to the planets, and, you know, certainly Riker in Next Gen,
mm-hmm.
You know, so Deep Space Nine.
Which makes a lot more logical sense.
Yeah. And Deep Space Nine, of course, didn't have as much, you know, beaming in. So not so many away missions. All right. Well, that is it for the feedback that we received. So thank you, all of you. Now it's up to us. So Adam, your first point.
Well, now that we've seen the entire pilot episode in both halves, right now I'm really chomping at the bit just to get to the next episode. I didn't realize that being 2 hours into this series, we wouldn't have started the series yet. I mean, this entire thing was basically a prologue that took 2 hours to tell. And so we still don't even know what direction the show is going to take from here.
Yeah, it reminds me, and this is even more so, this first season of Preacher. Do you watch Preacher?
I've been catching up on it, so I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. The whole first season of Preacher was a prologue to the second season and followed a much different format. And, you know, we got essentially, like we say, this is kind of like you know, a prequel to the actual series and the rest of it. And if I was thinking about this, like originally it was supposed to be 13 episodes and then they expanded it to 15. It's almost like, well, that's kind of what it was. It was like, so the two episodes are, you know, like your little TV movie, to start. And then, you know, now we'll have the actual 13 episode season.
Yeah, so they had the full season plotted out, and then they decided to bolt on all the flashback stuff as a prologue instead.
Yeah, although that's clearly not what they did. Or maybe they did at some point, and they didn't, you know, reveal that to us. But if you remember, the first, you know, casting announcements were characters that were in this episode, or these two episodes, like particularly Michelle Yeoh and James Frayne. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Doug Jones and that, like the characters that we actually interact with were early announcements. And yeah, I think they like announced Anthony Rapp, who we haven't seen yet. But most of the ones that they did mention were, you know, like I say, just in these two episodes. Okay. So my first point that I have to go with is, why is the crew so green when it comes to battle? Like, they don't know what a cloaking device is, clearly. They all seem to be explorers and have no actual combat experience. You know, like, I've, again, been watching Enterprise. We see, you know, the NX-01 got into a whole ton of scraps in the four seasons of Enterprise. So what? Like, and we know, or we believe, that the Federation was established based on, you know, going against the Romulans. And, you know, so I guess those things, you know, seceded, or, you know, kind of let go. And I guess the Klingons were in disarray because of the mutagenic virus, you know, and were squabbling with each other for 100 years. Gee whiz.
Klingons hold a grudge.
Do they ever? So the you know, it's, I just find it a bit of a stretch, I guess, that the Federation and Starfleet haven't had to haven't had conflict like all this time. They don't know these things. Like the, you know, I mentioned in the last episode that Burnham had to ask Sarek about the strategy. And you would think that if you're in Starfleet, yes, there are explorers and all of that, but there is a certain percentage of them that they have to defend themselves. And you would think they would know how to defend themselves against Klingons. Like, I think, getting to another question that Mark asked, was Burnham correct? Like, if they had fired first, would have it not created, you know, would have not started the war? I tend to think that if they had fired first, it probably would have avoided the war, because T'Kuvma and his assertions would have been false, right? They didn't. They wouldn't have come in peace. They would have fired first. So they would have, you know. So I think that I didn't agree with her approach, but certainly I think the that plan with the Klingons, if they had fired first, it would have ended up much differently.
I think they were stuck either way, actually, because if you fire first, well, then you're the aggressor and they will retaliate. If you don't fire first, you just feed into what T'Kuvma is saying about this grand lie of peace. I don't think there was any way to avoid it, actually.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of T'Kuvma's argument, though, is no matter what course of action the Federation took, he had a response ready that was going to justify it to the rest of the houses.
Yeah. What else you got?
Well, you've got a...
I
scanned over these notes, but wow, you were very, very thorough. All right, this might have belonged in weak sauce, but can we talk holograms, please?
Yes.
All right. This has bugged me even on my Star Wars cast as well, because the holograms are very popular in all forms of sci-fi. And let's talk about how these things would actually work. Every time we see a hologram, and especially here in Discovery, we see the person who's beaming in via hologram interacting with the physical environment at his beaming location. So, you know, the Admiral's talking to Georgiou in the ready room, and he's walking around and turning around when Burnham comes in behind him from the corridor. Now, unless his actual setting where he's broadcasting from is the exact same arrangement, there is no sense in that hologram interacting as though he's in the room with the physical people. Can someone please explain to me how that makes a lick of sense?
It makes no sense.
And the other thing that really scratched my head was, so he's already on via hologram to the Shenzhou. Then he wants to talk to the Klingons, and it appeared as though he was holographically telling the comm officer on the Shenzhou to connect him to the Klingon ship. Why wouldn't he just have his comm officer connect him straight through instead of basically forwarding the call? But if you remember, when he was actually beamed onto the bridge of the Shenzhou, he actually walked up the steps of the platforms of the bridge too. So apparently he's got stairs and everything in his room, wherever he's beaming from.
Yeah. There's no argument that makes any sense there, unless in, you know, where the hologram is, there's like some early holodeck, which, it, quite honestly, if they'd started showing holodecks, I would have like rage quit.
Right.
You know, that would have been far too far to go. I think that, you know, a lot of it was, you know, convenient. And, you know, we saw Sarek do something similar when he was talking to Burnham. I will say, and it's not really that, but I have to say that I really got a kick out of when Anderson there, Admiral, when they were, you know, getting rammed by T'Kuvma's ship, how it like bounced around, and, you know, it was just, it was really interesting the way that
I ship ramming is so much fun now that we have the effects budget and technology to make that look really good. At least as far as the cloaking devices go, they did actually address that plot point by saying that the Kovma had basically invented the cloak. I do remember Valk telling the rest of the Klingon houses that he invented a way to hide the ship.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we've always thought that the Klingons got their at least initial cloaking technology from the Romulans. That doesn't seem to be the case. So, you know, we don't know how the Kovma's ship has cloaking technology. And it seems like his ships are the ones that have it and the rest of the 24 houses don't. Because he made it sound very novel that they were able to, you know, cloak like they did. And clearly it's not as an advanced a cloak because they're still able to sense something out there. You know, we hear Saru say that, you know, like things are going haywire or whatever. And, you know, I can't make any sense of the readings. And so it's not as advanced a cloaking device, but like I said last week, we know the Suliban had it and I believe Romulans had it too. It just so much of this, that's those kind of choices that they made. I really question. I don't think they had to do that. They could have come up with something that was closer to what we're used to that would have make us stop asking these kind of questions. Like, why did you do that? I can't help it. Like the writer in me, you know, I think I told you, the other day, like I keep thinking of like 1995 Brian and that was kind of the critical year where I could have, you know, went out to LA, tried to make it as a writer, you know, if I'd been able to take the chances that I had to pitch stories to Star Trek, maybe, you know, got on and, you know, got like a little, you know, writer's assistant job or something. And, you know, today, the show was created by Brian Milosh. Yes. Thank you. Aww. But of course that didn't happen.
Well, then I'd just be monologuing this whole podcast. So that would be fun.
No.
I'm glad you're here, Brian.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I would not have made some of these decisions. You know, I would have – you could update the show without alienating the viewers that are, you know, hardcore fans. You could just make some smaller changes that – I think people would not have these same kind of questions about.
Well, at least by being totally mystified with the cloaking technology, they stayed away from Star Trek writers' favorite line, which is, it appears to be some sort of insert technology here. Hell, Burnham used it twice in the first episode. I counted it.
And of course, Saru just said, unknown object, which I got a kick out of. Okay, well,
and then Georgiou says, "Can you be more specific?"
Yeah. All right. I want to take a few minutes and analyze kind of like what we see with the whole Klingon, you know, thing, and particularly T'Kuvma, and how it kind of is an allegory to today, because that, you know, of course, has always been you know, a method of storytelling that, you know, you're talking about the things going on today, by, you know, coming up with some kind of equivalent for the future. Like I thinking of the Riker episode, The Outcast, where, you know, it's essentially, you know, talking about, you know, being gay essentially. And the character is from an alien race where there is no gender and she develops feelings for Riker and that's considered, you know, not
gender cool. Specific. Yeah.
Yeah. So just, first of all, I will say that, the analysis of T'Kuvma's argument, essentially, he says that, the Federation aims to destroy the Klingon sense of individuality. you know, to me means that, you know, he's projecting, what a relationship with the Federation would look like, and that, you know, eventually they, you know, their culture would be kind of like meshed into the Federation, and, you know, they'd eventually become, members of the Federation, and how that would, kind of, put a kibosh to the individuality of, you know, what it means to be Klingon. You know, you can't, essentially, someone like Worf in T'Kuvma's, idea couldn't really exist, you know, like someone in the Federation that's still Klingon.
No, he's an abomination.
Right, right. So that, you know, now, first of all, the Klingons are still not a part of the Federation. They're allies. Like, I'm thinking of, you know, as far ahead, like 24th century, you know, Klingon Federation relations. They're allies, but they've never joined the Federation. So, you know, that part of, you know, he's fear mongering, I think, but it reminds me of like a lot of different, you know, political movements. And the one I was thinking of is Brexit, you know, so the UK decides to essentially, you know, leave the, European Union. And I think a lot of those kind of arguments of like, you know, being able to kind of, set your own destiny, you know, and the fact that, you know, they weren't able to, you know, have their own currency and things like that, like, you know, set their own policy, essentially similar kind of idea, I think. And T'Kuvma's an outsider, you know, not part of the 24 great houses, which of course reminds me of Trump. And, you know, he was very much an outsider of the Republican Party, that rose to power using, you know, like T'Kuvma says, make Klingons great again, essentially, is what he's saying. And that's an argument that's similar to Trump's make America great again. So I don't want to get political for any of that stuff. I just find it interesting how they're using things that are happening today in the story, and projecting it into, you know, 23rd century. So,
yeah. And as much as they said before that when the original series aired, the Klingons were an allegory for the Russians. The Klingons, they serve a different role in this, obviously. But it's still a very xenophobic agenda that T'Kuvma was pushing. And it's relevant once again. And I don't think it strays that far from the archetype of the Klingons, though. So it's fascinating that they can tie it to contemporary events, yet still not stray from the template that they've established for Klingon behavior.
I think that, you know, although, you know, I've criticized the look of the Klingons, I think the behavior was very Klingon, you know, so I didn't really have issue with the way that the Klingons, you know, the Klingon dynamic, the Klingon characters seemed Klingon to me. So I think that's the most important part. So,
yeah.
One final thing about Klingon, I had seen in a few places people asking a question like, why are these Klingons acting without honor? But I had to go back to, and I had to go look to see where it actually was mentioned. But, it was in Deep Space Nine, and it was, season four, the very first episode, of the season where Worf, you know, comes on board Deep Space Nine, and that was called The Way of the Warrior. And, in speaking about the Klingons, Worf said, in war, there is nothing more honorable than victory. So, if some people thought that, you know, kind of doing what T'Kuvma did, you know, with the decloaking, you know, and ramming the Europa, that being like, you know, deceitful or dishonorable, to Klingons, the most honorable thing is winning. So, you know, that's the Charlie Sheen school of thought.
It's a handy little cop out for the writers. You know, it's like in the Avengers when all of a sudden, apparently Bruce Banner can turn into the Hulk at will, when that was always one of the challenges before. the same here, where every time the Klingons needed to display some sort of different behavior, they just wrote some new bit into the lore that would explain how it still fell in line with their worldview.
Yeah. So getting to the Federation, I thought it was interesting to see, you know, when they name ships, they usually name them after something that we know. And I was curious in this case, like the ships that they mentioned. Of course, the Shenzhou or Shenzhou is named after, you know, the Chinese spacecraft, you know, part of their space program. I think another ship that was mentioned was the Clark. And according to captions, it was Clark with an E. And I think that means Arthur C. Clarke, you know. I heard Shran. Of course, that's Commander Shran from Enterprise, the Andorian commander.
Thank you, Jeffrey Combs.
Yes. T'Plana Hoth. That was mentioned a couple of places. T'Plana Hoth is the, I think I'm saying that right, is the matron of Vulcan philosophy. So
that's interesting to have a Vulcan named ship in the fleet.
Yeah. Well, no, I would expect that. You know, because back at this time, you would expect that there'd be kind of like all Vulcan ships that are, you know, that are largely a Vulcan crew, you know. So I would expect Vulcan, you know, like you have a Shran, so that's an Andorian named after an Andorian, the T'Plana Hoth named after Vulcan, sorry. So, Kerala, the only thing I could find for that is it's a state in India. One I had a hard time figuring out what it was is Sioux. And the only thing I could find, and this is a stretch and it's a guess, but there was a writer, French writer named Eugene Sioux, and he is considered one of the originators of the serial novel. So I think that's kind of like an homage to, you know, the fact that Discovery is a serial story as opposed to an episodic story.
Either that or it's referring to the Sioux tribe of Native Americans.
Yeah, except in the captions it was S-U-E. So,
oh, you've clearly done your research much more thoroughly than I have.
Well, there was one that I didn't get, and that was the USS Dana. So was that Dana Scully, maybe? X-Files? I don't know. It's the only thing. I just thought of that just now.
Sue and Dana, they might have been interns on the production for all we know.
Maybe. The USS Ride, that must obviously be Sally Ride, the first American female astronaut who actually passed away of cancer recently. The USS Earhart, obviously that's Amelia Earhart. The USS Edison, that's obvious what that is, Thomas Edison. The USS Jaeger, that's, you know, test pilot Chuck Jaeger. And, of course, the moon Europa, I would think that's what they had to have named it, so, after. But, anyway, always interesting to see that. One final question in this section. Are you surprised that Burnham got a life sentence?
I thought that was pretty harsh. I guess there was really nothing to contradict the charges against her. So I think the reason it was so surprising was because there's always a way out in Star Trek. We anyone who ever gets court-martialed in previous Star Trek series, always there's either a mitigating circumstance or they, I don't know, go back in time and change what happened. Or I mean, there's any number of ways to get out of a court-martial. The fact that this one stuck is really the shocking factor.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, you know, we talked about it last episode, you know, wondered, you know, if she was going to get demoted. Well, she obviously got a little more than demoted. We had wondered if she was going to go to prison, which not only does she go to prison, but she goes for life. So, although, you know, judging by the sneak peek, that doesn't exactly take. So I'm surprised that it was a life sentence. That seemed very much against, you know, the types of sentences we've seen in past Star Trek, you know, like that the Federation, you know, is with their techniques are, you know, much more trying to reform people. So, you know, I guess because of treason, and I think maybe that Burnham had a target on her forehead because, you know, she is essentially blamed as the person that started the Klingon War, you know.
Yeah.
That's what it seems to be. That's what they're hinting at, it seems. So, all right. So, I think that's it for our thoughts about this episode, but a few other things that we want to talk about with mind of you know, the show going forward. But one little segment I want to bring out, you know, we may not bring this out every week, but it's Spot the 47. So if you go back to Next Generation, there's been a whole thing where the number 47 has to exist in the episode somewhere. And this was originally brought in by Joe Manosky, who, strangely enough, he's like the one tie to the Next Generation that's still, and, you know, the other shows, other than Brian Fuller. Manosky, you know, was a writer on, you know, Next Gen and I think Voyager, possibly Deep Space Nine. I don't think he was ever on the Enterprise show, but he was on the rest. And he was the guy that brought in the number 47. So and actually J.J. Abrams also has used the number 47 in a lot of his work. And we actually saw that in Star Trek, I think certainly the first Star Trek movie. So it's when Georgiou says that the, that I'll just play it.
They're going to self-destruct.
Shields up to 47%.
So I thought that was interesting.
I was totally unaware of that little bit of trivia until you pointed it out. Now I'm going to be focusing on it and hunting for it every week.
Yeah. We were going to talk more about After Trek. I'll just say that I think it needs some work. So
we'll stay tuned on that one. But so far, meh.
Yeah, I think that it will get better as the season goes. But I think it was certainly not quite there. All right. For our American viewers, we have to talk about CBS All Access. So I'm going to let you just talk a little bit about it because you, like you said, you watched essentially both episodes on that app.
Yeah, I've tried it in three different iterations so far. I've tried it on my phone. I viewed it through my laptop, through their website. And I also downloaded the app on my PS4. So trying all the different platforms. The biggest problem I've got is playback stutters. Have you noticed that, Brian?
Yeah, I noticed that a few times. I noticed episodes getting listed multiple times in the it had both episodes listed twice at one point. I thought that was weird, but I did notice some skipping, and it's really annoying, those commercials, because you can't. You can't skip through them. You can't, if you go backwards, you'll end up seeing them again. If you, try to like fast forward things and, start at, in the middle or something, if you're looking for a certain clip, you have to sit through like 3 minutes of commercials. Really, really annoying. I am going to go to the commercial free, once my trial is up. It's largely because I'm podcasting about it, and I'm also podcasting on the two Walking Dead shows on the same night, so I'm just getting it because I want to be efficient, but it's annoying. And the worst thing about it that I really, really don't like, I mentioned this to you today, no rewind. Like like with Netflix, there's like a button, you know, to go back, you know, 10 seconds or 30 seconds. There's nothing like that on the CBS All Access app.
Yeah. The playback controls are very puzzling in that aspect.
Yeah.
I think the ads are the bigger problem, though. You're looking at a $6 a month service with TV length commercial breaks when you can get Hulu, which also has CBS content and original content and every other network's content, for $8 a month. And that has limited ads, much more limited. There's shorter commercial breaks. And as you were saying, if you do jump back and forth in time in the episode, you can't ever avoid repeating the commercial break. There needs to be some sort of tracking that says, okay, they've already seen all the commercials they should for this episode. They're allowed to jump around now. Because I had the same problem where, especially with the playback stutters and whatnot, I would go back just to make sure I hadn't missed something and have to watch another 2.5 minute commercial break.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's not the typical 30 seconds or a minute like most internet services. It's 2.5 minutes. That's a lengthy investment. So why am I paying for the privilege of online streaming and still getting the advertisers shoved in my face? Isn't the price of the streaming service supposed to offset the advertising dollars?
You would think. About the only like time savings that you get out of it, if you do have the commercials, is there's no local commercials. You know, so I didn't see anything about like Cleveland 19, you know, news or something like that.
Yeah.
They at least didn't have that, but
they did try to sell me a Hyundai Sonata about 15 times per episode, though. They've got the same length of commercial break. They just have fewer commercials to fill it with. So you get a lot of repeats.
Yeah. All right. So now we get to the big question, I think. So if you're in most of the world, you're watching this on Netflix, and I think your decision is, do you watch it week to week or do you binge watch it at the end? And, you know, I'm not going to really answer that question because I think that's a subjective thing. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, how you watch TV, and do you prefer to binge, and do you also, do you have the patience to wait? You know, so to me, I don't know if you have any opinion about it, but as far as binging versus not binging, I think that is up to you as the viewer. And, you know, that's what I would say. And that's true for CBS All Access or Netflix. As far as the Canadian viewer, I think that that's kind of a moot point because it's on basic cable. But anyway, what do you think about that? Like binge versus not binge?
I agree with you. It's up to your personal viewing preference. I would love to be able to binge this show simply because where the end of this episode left us, I can't wait for the next one. So that's a testament to the credit of the writing, I suppose, is that it's frustrating not being able to binge it because I'm so invested in what happens next.
Yeah, like particularly me, if I wasn't, that would be the question, Adam. Like if we weren't podcasting about it, right? If we were just viewers of this show, would you binge or would you watch it week to week?
You know, I've never tried to keep current with a series that was online streaming that came out on a network drip. So I don't really have that experience, but I would say that probably just based on the hype and the coverage that this show is receiving, I would want to watch it as it comes out simply so nothing gets spoiled for me.
I am right there with you. That would be my answer. So, and you know, my equivalent, I guess, would be HBO Now, because that's how I watch, you know, Game of Thrones and other stuff on HBO, is through their app, and that is dropped, you know, week to week in a similar way. And you know, I watch those shows week to week as well. So, but bottom line, if you are a Star Trek fan, do you get CBS All Access? Do you get it later, or do you like hope for it to come out on Netflix or on Blu-ray? I mean, to those people that have those questions, what's your advice, Adam?
Well, I'm assuming that everybody listening to this show is keeping current with the series. What I'd be interested to do is take this once the mid-season break hits and binge the first half and see how it all ties together one after the other. My advice would be to keep current with it just so you're not spoiled, really. I mean, that's the worst thing, is to go into a show knowing what happens already.
My take on it is, you know, should you watch the show? I think I already answered the question. I think if you're a Star Trek fan and you could accept change, you watch the show. I think by the end of this first season, we're going to love it. It's going to be great Star Trek and great TV. It's going to be different than what we're used to, but it's going to be great. But it's a question of, do you binge it or do you watch week to week? Now, you might say binge it, you know, after the first half comes out, you know, if that's what you want to do. I can see that, you know. I don't know if I would want to wait until the whole season's done. That's a long time, because like you say, you pretty much get spoiled. So I think it's a question of whether you get it now or you get it like in November and, you know, binge the first half. But if you're a Star Trek fan, I think this is worth watching. I think it is worth getting the CBS All Access. And yeah, I know you don't want to, but it's $6. I mean, and even if you get it commercial free, it's $10. It's not a fortune. I mean, if you had to, like you mentioned before, if you buy these episodes outright, if you're doing it on a, you know, Google Play or TV
Amazon
app,
video
Apple,
or
Amazon,
yeah, anything.
Yeah, it'd be like $3 an episode. So you're definitely saving money in that way. Now, whether or not you keep your membership during the hiatus, that's a whole other thing. And that depends on whether or not, you know, you want the other content. For me personally, you know, after I maybe get out like a binge watch of the first half, I'm probably going to drop it, you know, for December and bring it back, you know, in January. I might keep it. I don't know. We'll see. But I don't see keeping membership year round.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see what happens with the licensing agreements with the other streaming services for CBS content. They might start going the Disney route of shutting those other streams off to, you know, focus on their exclusive platform. But currently, every other Star Trek series is available on other platforms. So if the whole sales pitch is, you can watch every Star Trek ever, well, we can do that anyway, with the exception of Discovery.
Now, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, a year or two from now, CBS does a Disney and, you know, starts pulling their stuff from, you know, other streaming services. 'Cause like if they want to sell CBS All Access, that would be, one of the ways to make it like the exclusive streaming provider for Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that may happen. Although, considering the deal that they have with Netflix, that may not happen either. I know that CBS All Access is actually coming to Canada, and I don't think they're actually going to have Discovery on it because of the deal that they have with Bell Media and, you know, it being on space. But I don't know. That could be wrong. Mark, for one thing, you might know. I know there's a few other GJ, for one, and Karen, I've seen from something I put on the Facebook group this week or today, just asking where people were. There were several Canadians that responded. So, you know, you guys may correct me on that. It's been a while since I've been back. So anyway, that's it. Hopefully that was informative for you. And if you have any differing opinions, be good. We'll certainly let those out on the next episode. So if somebody wants to submit feedback, Adam, how would they do so?
Well, we've got a couple different channels. We have a few different ways. You can always go to our Facebook group. That's a pretty healthy discussion place. That's available at facebook.com/groups/StarTrekDiscoveryPodcast. We also have our Twitter handle. For those of you who like to tweet back and forth, we are at StarTrekGSM. You can send us an email at StarTrekGSM@gmail.com. Or if voicemail is your thing, we also have a voicemail line at 304-837-2278. When you call that, just mention you're leaving feedback for the Star Trek Discovery podcast, and we'll be sure to get that. And you can also go to our feedback form, which is at www.goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback. You can do text or audio there, or use the SpeakPipe widget, actually. So lots of different ways to get in touch with the show.
So our deadline for feedback for next week's episode is Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central. And I don't know, I think hopefully those of you that are watching, you know, overseas, internationally, you will be able to get the episode by then. You know, if that's not true, send in your feedback whenever you can. I'll say that. So, best way.
For our overseas listeners, I'd be curious to know when the shows do drop. So please drop us a line and let us know when you're watching the show.
Yeah, I am curious of that too. I've heard conflicting stories of that. So the best way you can support us is through currently by subscribing to us. Subscribing whatever podcast app you have, but especially on Apple Podcasts, it actually helps move us up in the ratings. And we've actually been doing quite well in the ratings. We've been we're high up if you do a Star Trek Discovery search, and we even like we're in the top 200 pretty much all week except for today. We dropped off finally off the top 200 in TV and film. So I think that is awesome. So thank all of you for making that happen, because that's all you guys.
Yes, a huge. Well, that pretty much says it right there. I was just going to say a huge thank you from me as well. That really helps to support the show. And we love all the feedback and all the participation and support you guys have given us so far.
You can also help us, especially on Apple Podcasts or the iTunes app, by leaving a rating or especially a review. That really helps get the word out. Actually, subscribing, I've learned, is more important. But secondly, ratings and reviews are important. Hopefully, you'd give us a 5-star. And if not, as we've said, just, you know, be truthful and be constructive, as Nathan tried to be constructive with his feedback on the Facebook group as well. And I thought it was actually, hopefully we did what you think what we did was a little bit better for you. So, anyway, we do have a Patreon coming up. We will probably get that set up in the next week or two, and just trying to figure out what we're going to offer to Patreon supporters. But we'll have more about that. But keep in mind, you know, that will help support us. So, but there are other ways to support the network as well at goldenspiralmedia.com/support. Take us out.
All right. Well, we've got our next episode coming up. This Sunday's episode is episode 3 of season 1, called Context is for Kings. As of my last bit of research, we did not yet have a writing credit on this episode, but it is directed by Akiva Goldsman. So that should be interesting to see what he does with his turn in the big chair. And no episode synopsis provided as of yet. So I'm not going to risk ending up on errata yet again by saying what's going to happen on this episode. I'll just leave it up to CBS All Access to tell me what's going on Sunday.
Well, I will, you know, stick my neck out and say, you know, like you tried to say last episode, I think we will see the Discovery this episode finally. So
are you calling for a Lorca sighting?
I think we will have a Lorca sighting and a Discovery sighting.
It's only 3 hours into the series. Why show the ship yet, right?
All right. Well, that's it for this episode. So until next time, I'm Brian.
And I'm still Adam.
Peace and long life.
And live long and prosper.